Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 14th of January 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We are not actually live tonight, this is pre-recorded, but I do have my co-host with me, the Patriarch from PatrioticArts.community and also from the Patriarch channel on Telegram. Patriarch, how are you doing? How is life for you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, life's all right. Just getting used to, getting back into the flow of work, especially after a long Christmas. I always find it hard to just adjust back into a work routine and that. But I'm there now, so it's all good.
Yeah, I'm finding it hard to adjust with a podcast. I'm sort of getting my words mixed up in my intros and my outros. I'm sure I'll get used to it again. That's what happens when you take 2 weeks off and you're used to working every day. Well, we do have an exciting episode in store for tonight. We're going to be particularly looking at Carthage. Last week, we finished up with an overview of the achievements of the Phoenicians, and this week we will be concentrating on one of their colonies in particular, Carthage, which is in modern-day Tunisia. And I do wonder that car at the beginning there's a lot of places that have that car, Carchemish as well, and then you end up with Cardiff and Carmarthen, and you still get that car word in Wales today, which provides a link to the Near East. Yeah. Although it's spelled with definitely. An E in Welsh.
But the language itself is very linked. It's probably one of the closest to Hebrew amongst all the British languages, I think.
That's isn't what it? I've read. It would be good to actually find some more on that and add that to an episode here, because that ties in with what we were talking about last week as well, with Phoenician being the root of all the languages which actually use alphabets, and also particularly... Yeah. Hebrew. But as I say, I wanted to get particularly into Carthage this week. Dido, also known as Alyssa, was the legendary founder of the city and the first queen of the Phoenician city-state of Carthage, located in modern Tunisia. Known only through ancient Greek and Roman sources, most of which were written well after Carthage's founding, her historicity remains uncertain. In most accounts, she was the queen of the Phoenician city-state of Tyre, which is today in Lebanon, who fled tyranny to found her own city in northwest Africa. Now, we do find Hebrew legends about this, that this Dido, this Alyssa, was in actual fact a grandniece of Ahab and Jezebel. And I'm sure you'll probably remember this, Patriarch. There's a bit in the Old Testament where there's a drought because the Israelites are worshipping Baal. And there's a complete drought. And then Elijah comes out and he manages to light the fire, even though it's covered in rain, and all the priests of Baal are unable to. And during that drought, this was the period when Carthage was founded. And it looks like a lot of the Israelites from the northern house of Israel that were allied with Sidon and Tyre, that they moved to Carthage, and they came with them came this princess, Alyssa. And obviously because of this Baal worship, this is why we get this paganism in Carthage, which we will also be looking at. But she's also mentioned in the Enid. Details about Dido's character, life, and role in the founding of Carthage are best known from the account given in Virgil's epic poem, the Enid, which tells the legendary story of the Trojan hero, Innes. Dido is described as a clever and enterprising woman who flees her ruthless and autocratic brother, Pygmalion, after discovering that he was responsible for her husband's death. Through her wisdom and leadership, the city of Carthage is founded and made prosperous. So we have this other story there of the same person, and she's the daughter of the king of Tyre, I believe it is. Sidon and Tyre, they were the two main cities. Many names in the legend of Dido are of Punic origin, and Punic was just the northern African name for the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians that were in Phoenicia, Lebanon, Syria, they were referred to as Phoenicians, and the ones that were on North Africa were referred to as Punics, but they were essentially the same people, as this was a colony that was started up by them. Many of these legends, or many names in the legend of Dido, are of Punic origin, which suggests that the first Greek authors who mention this story have taken up Phoenician accounts. One suggestion is that Dido is an epithet from the same Semitic root as David, which means beloved. Others state that Dido means the wanderer. According to Marie-Pierre Noël, Elishat or Elisha is a name repeatedly attested on Punic votives. It is composed of the Punic reflex of Il, which means God, the remote Phoenician creator god El, also a name for God among the Israelites, and Issa, which could be either Is, meaning fire, or another word for woman. Other works state that it is the feminine form of El. In Greek, it appears as Theoso, which translates Elissa. El becoming Theos. So we have this Shemitic word there, and in actual fact, in Carthage, there are loads of words that are Hebrew words. The actual name for the judges, basically the people that were in charge, is exactly the same name as the judges had in the Bible, in the Old Testament. And the priests there were called Kohanim, which is the exact name that the priest had. In the Old Testament, we see all these Hebrew words that are being used there, actually, that we found through our archaeology today. And of course, it makes all the archaeologists question and say, well, how could this be? And of course, the reason why that was is because it was the northern house of Israel. It wasn't Judah. Judah and Benjamin were at war with Israel most of the time, and they didn't actually have an alliance with Sidon and Tyre. It was Samaria. It was the northern house of Israel that was allied with Sidon and Tyre. So we see the first link there actually comes from her name.
Did you want Sidon and Tyre, though? Last week we discussed about them still harboring Israelites, right?
Oh yeah. Sidon and Tyre had Israelites, so there.
Wouldn't they be part of the Northern Kingdom?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They're part of the Northern Kingdom. The Northern Kingdom was an alliance: Sidon, Tyre, and Samaria.
Samaria, right?
Yeah.
Yes, it's quite confusing though, isn't it? I mean, we should really try and pinpoint which specific tribes were settled in which specific areas. I think that's where a lot of the confusion comes in, isn't it?
Well, we talked about that when we went through the episode. It was a specific proportion. That was assorted to these tribes was Sidon and Tyre, and then they removed the Canaanites, and the Canaanites were outside. But then over time, the Canaanites came back in again, and you had multicultural, even though they were white and the Canaanites were sort of off-white, nearly white. We're not talking about African tribes people there. So you had, and that's why you had this paganism that crept in. You know, Solomon took on foreign wives. So I couldn't tell you off the top of my head exactly which tribes were given that area, but it would have been one of the 10 tribes. It wasn't Judah and Benjamin. Judah and Benjamin had Jerusalem and that area around there, and the northern house of Israel had the area that joined up with Sidon and Tyre, basically.
Yeah, I think it would be easier to you could work it out for sure, because I know that earlier on in Exodus, especially when it talked about going into the land of Canaan, it kind of told them which areas to settle in. Might not have been so specific for all of them, but by sort of trial of elimination, you can kind of just have a bit of guesswork, couldn't you, which specific ones were most likely to settle here because they weren't referenced elsewhere.
I think they were given specific proportions. I mean, like, they took Moab first, didn't they? And the people and the tribes that were going to take over Moab said, well, we'll stay here in the bits that we've got.
Yeah.
And they were told, no, you can't do that. You can leave the women there, and you can leave like a small group looking after them, but you have to come and fight with the rest of us. So that we know, so there were areas that were taken over at first. But I mean, I couldn't tell you exactly which ones, but we do know that at the time of Solomon and David, it was still a united kingdom, and Solomon was working with Hiram, the king in Sidon, or whoever was the ruler of Sidon, was working with Solomon and providing the carpenters and the timber and all of that for building Solomon's temple. And this is like some time after that.
Yeah.
Basically. Justin, quoting or paraphrasing Trogus, states, "A king of Tyre, whom Justin does not name, made his very beautiful daughter Dido and son Pygmalion his joint heirs. But on his death, the people took Pygmalion alone as their ruler, although Pygmalion was yet still a boy. Dido married Acerbus, her uncle, who as a priest of Hercules, that is Melkart, was second in power to King Pygmalion. Acerbus can be equated with Zicabal, the king of Byblos, mentioned in the Egyptian tale of Wienamon. Rumour told that Acerbus had much wealth secretly buried, and Pygmalion had Acerbus murdered in the hopes of gaining this wealth. Dido, desiring to escape Tyre, expressed a wish to move into Pygmalion's palace, but then ordered the attendants whom Pygmalion sent to aid in the move to throw all Acerbus's bags of gold into the sea, apparently as an offering to his spirit." Well, she is, yeah, a bit of a feminist there, isn't she? Throwing all the money away out of spite. "In fact, these bags contained only sand." Ah, very clever. "Dido then persuaded the attendants to join her in flight to another land rather than face Pygmalion's anger when he discovered what had supposedly become of Acerbus's wealth, and some senators also joined her in her flight." So we have a sort of confirmation of this, that she was the daughter of a king of Tyre, and we know that Jezebel was one of the princesses of Tyre, and it was apparently this Dido was either a niece of hers or some kind of relative of hers. "The party arrived at Cyprus, where the priest of Jupiter joined the expedition. There the exiles also seized about 80 young women who were prostituting themselves on the shore in order to provide wives for the men in the party. Eventually Dido and her followers arrived on the coast of North Africa, where Dido asked the Berber king Yabus for a small bit of land for a temporary refuge until she could continue her journeying, only as much land as could be encompassed by an oxhide. And they agreed. Dido cut the oxhide into fine strips so that she had enough to encircle an entire nearby hill, which was therefore afterwards named Byrza, or Hyde. And this event is commemorated in modern mathematics, the isoperimetric problem of enclosing the maximum area within a fixed boundary is often called the Dido problem in modern calculus of variations, and that would become their new home." And this I find very interesting, because exactly the same thing is supposed to have occurred with the Saxons when they came to England. They came to England to fight for the king that we had here, and I momentarily forget his name. And they said, "Well, we would like to stay here." And he said, "Okay, well, how much land do you want?" And they said, "Well, we want just enough land that we can fit within an ox's skin." And the king said, "Yeah, okay." And they did the same thing. They cut the ox skin really thin, and it actually encircled the whole of Kent. So they had the whole of Kent.
Wow.
Vortigern, that was the name of the king. Vortigern.
Wow.
So I don't know whether that that was just something that some people used to do in ancient days, or whether this story of what this Saxon king, Hengist and Horsa, that's who it was, or whether Hengist and Horsa's story had been grafted on, or they'd actually taken the idea from this earlier story with Dido, or what. But it is interesting that exactly the same thing is supposed to have occurred in England. And as we say, these are white people.
It doesn't sound like a common thing, like a regular thing someone would do, would it?
No, it's just, bizarre coincidence. "Many of the local Berbers joined the settlement, and both Berbers and envoys from the nearby Phoenician city of Utica urged the building of a city. In digging the foundations, an ox's head was found, indicating a city that would be wealthy but would be subject to others. Accordingly, another area of the hill was dug instead, where a horse's head was found, indicating that the city would be powerful in war. And you can see why they would think that an ox would be subject to its owner, and a horse would be powerful in war. I believe they used to bury parts of bodies in foundations, and also at the foundation of cities and in the foundation of houses. An old supernatural belief many years ago. Yes.
So it's a superstitious thing.
Yeah. So it's not just that they actually found this there when they were digging the foundations, but it is something that we used to do in the past. Like a sort of sacrifice at the start of something. And also when it's talking about the Berbers here, obviously the Berbers were white. They're still mainly white today, although they have a lot of Caucasian DNA, the North African Berbers. If you look at what they look like what the Moors look like in the paintings of the Moors from, I think, 13th, 14th century, they're still looking white by that time. The whole world used to be much whiter.
Which were dark-skinned, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, the Nubians are down further down the south as well. What we're talking about here is North Africa. If you draw a line from Libya right the way across the north there and the bit that the boats head off from to get to Italy. So you've got Libya. Well, you've got Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and all along there, all along North Africa. And then you've got the Sahara, and then underneath the Sahara, you had the black Africans, and they couldn't get through the Sahara. They were stuck down the bottom.
Yeah, who was it? Which group in particular were the ones which infiltrated in Italy and Sardinia and places like that? It's quite renowned for kind of intermixing with some of the southern Italians.
I think that was to do with slavery, when they had black slaves. There was a lot of black slaves in Portugal and also in Italy and Spain. So once the Arabs were taking the black Africans as slaves, there was a slave trade in the south of Europe as well. And there was interbreeding with these slaves. And that that messed up the genome. But there was other things that messed it up as well. I mean, you had, especially with the Portuguese used to have a massive empire, and they sent out explorers. And that's why you have Portuguese Goa in India, and people speak Portuguese and Spanish in South America. But so many of their alpha males actually left that there wasn't really enough to keep the place going. So all the very best of their stock actually left the country, and then you ended up with some interbreeding with the black African stock, and that's why there's no Portuguese empire anymore, and that's why they've got a lower IQ. They didn't always used to have that, but they spread themselves too thin, and all the very best people left there and went to these far flung colonies, basically.
And Portugal is very a mixed cultural architecture. There's a lot of mosques there, ancient mosques as well. And also you can tell, I mean, there are some Portuguese which look, it's typically white, but you can see the Arab injection in a lot of them.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of mixing went on in Portugal. It's not to say all Portuguese are non-white, but there's more mixing that went on there than, say, in the north of Europe. Of course, it's now going on everywhere because it's multicultural everywhere. But back then, I think there was a lot more white people in the world than there are today by percentage of the population. And the black Africans were relatively cut off from everybody else in their own little part of the world at the bottom of Africa there. So when we think of Africans at this time, it's wrong to think of black Africans. You have to think of Phoenicians and Berbers and the various others that were there in North Africa.
Their population pretty much soared and boomed when whites intervened and gave a lot of the infrastructure. And I think it was the creation of the nations, wasn't it? And set up governments for different nation states. And I think that was really the catalyst to the explosion in population.
And giving them medicine. And food aid and all the rest of it. Of course, once you have it interfered in the natural growth of a people, then morally it's your responsibility to then make sure nothing goes wrong. So it's really a burden that we put upon ourselves by interfering in their natural evolution like that. So that's why we have this moral duty, I suppose, to keep an eye on them and help them out. And obviously, I think the best way to help them out would be in Africa rather than encouraging them all to come to Europe, all the surplus population to come to Europe. But back then, we didn't have this problem. The mixing would have been with Arabs, and the Arabs themselves wouldn't have been that mixed. They would have been much lighter than they are today.
Yeah.
When the new city of Carthage had become established and prosperous, Iarbas, a native king of the Mauritani, demanded Dido for his wife, or he would make war on Carthage. Still, she preferred to stay faithful to her first husband, and after creating a ceremonial funeral pyre and sacrificing many victims to his spirit in pretense that this was a final honouring of her first husband in preparation for marriage to Iarbas, Dido ascended the pyre, announcing that she would go to her husband as they desired, and then slew herself with her sword. After this self-sacrifice, Dido was deified and was worshipped as long as Carthage endured. In this account, the foundation of Carthage occurred 72 years before the foundation of Rome. And that's quite important that the Phoenicians had this empire, and they were the biggest and most advanced nation before the Greeks and before the Romans. And a lot of the Greek ideas and the Roman ideas actually came from the Phoenicians. And we can see here that they were into human sacrifice. They did have this human sacrifice thing going. And this is the reason why the Israelites lost their lands in the first place, is because they started following these pagan ideas, this Baal worship. And it got as far as Britain because, you know, we have the word Baal in the word Beltane, which is one of our festivals, and Easter, the word that we still use, Easter, which you also use for estrogen, that again comes from one of these Near Eastern goddesses. So the language of these pagan ideas that had fertility rituals and also human sacrifice, that the language that was used in that is also in our English language today and in our place names, and we did used to follow this sort of stuff. Sadly, you know, we can't pretend we're above it all. Evidence for the historicity of Dido, which is a question independent of whether or not she ever met Ennius, can be associated with evidence for the historicity of others in her family, such as her brother Pygmalion and their grandfather Belazaros. Both of these kings are mentioned, as well as Dido, in the list of Tyrian kings given in Menander of Ephesus's list of the kings of Tyre, as preserved in Josephus's Against Apion. And this is quite important, that so much of the old history books that we used to have are now no longer here, but parts of them are preserved in other history books. And this was the good thing about Flavius Josephus, and he would actually have whole quotes, or he would tell us exactly what happened in these history books. And because we know that there was nobody saying, well, don't believe Josephus, his histories are a load of rubbish at the time, we know that he's actually giving us an accurate representation of what was in these earlier history books. So this is where we get this list of Tyrian kings. It's in Josephus's work Against Apion, where he basically challenges Apion's version of history. And Josephus ends his quotation of Menander with the sentence, "Now in the seventh year of Pygmalion's reign, his sister fled away from him and built the city of Carthage in Libya." So, you know, we have a pretty certain reference there in Josephus that she existed. Yeah. One tradition, that of the Greek historian Timaeus from 345 to 260 BC, gives 814 BC for the founding of Carthage. Traditionally, most modern scholars have preferred this 814 date. So when we think about that date, and you think about the time that you were referring to earlier, Patriarch, about when Sidon and Tyre were actually taken over by the Israelites, it was probably some 400 years before that, before this time. So in that time, you would get movement of peoples, you would end up with more of the Canaanites moving into that area again, and that's why you got these pagan ideas. You can't
so,
say...
Yeah, so Carthage was after that.
Yeah, Carthage, yeah, wasn't it? Yeah, Carthage was 400 years later.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating. I mean, I thought that, typically speaking, most people would say that, ancient Greece was the founding of civilization, wouldn't they? But really it's, when you look at the Mesopotamia and then obviously more closer to Europe, Carthage, it's just not really common knowledge.
No, most people think it began with the Greeks. And as you say, it started in Mesopotamia, and then you had the Phoenicians, and then you had the Greeks. And the religious ideas, the mythic ideas that the Greeks had, they got theirs from the Phoenicians, and the Phoenicians got theirs from the Israelites, and also from the Mesopotamians. I mean, you look at Hercules, that's Samson from the Old Testament. Mm. And as it was saying here, when they were tracing Dido's name as Elissa, they were using the word El, and El was the name that the Israelites used for God or Yahweh. In our Old Testament, it has Elohim in Genesis, and that was the word that was actually used. So it made its way down through the Hebrews to the Israelites to the Phoenicians, and it was used by the Canaanites as well. El was a part of the Canaanite canon of deities, and I forget which one it was in the Mesopotamians as well. The Sumerians had a similar name. Go on.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say a lot of people think because of these names, these words like El, that's why they assume that, Christianity and the Old Testament is like a desert religion kind of that stemmed from Egypt. And it's really the opposite way around.
It was a white religion. All these peoples were originally white. Civilization is something unique to white people, really, apart from perhaps the Chinese. And from when we looked at China, I mean, it looks to me as if it was white people that brought it to China as well. And the Chinese had a high enough IQ to be able to keep it going. But I'm not so certain these other peoples can keep it going, because they live in amongst the ruins of civilizations. If you look at India and Egypt, it's full of ruins of previous civilizations, some of which we've yeah. talked about. Getting back to this tradition of the Greek historian Timaeus, who gives 814, the publication of the Shalmaneser text mentioning tribute from Baal Issa II of Tyre in 841 BC caused a re-examination of this question, since the best texts of Menander and Josephus only allow 22 years from the accession of Baal Issa or Belezeros until the seventh year of Pygmalion, and measuring back from 814 BC would not allow any overlap of Belezeros with the 841 tribute to Shalmaneser. And I think Shalmaneser is mentioned in the Old Testament. Either that or the Shalmaneser, there's a stone which actually has something to do with him that's written on there, I think. They've certainly found proof of Shalmaneser, and what they're mentioning here, this Shalmaneser text, that must be something that's carved into a stone. I'm forgetting the actual name of what these stones are called. There's a specific name for them, which momentarily escapes me. With the 825 date for the seventh year of Pygmalion, however, Belezeros' last year would coincide with 841 BC, the year of the tribute. Additional evidence in favour of the 825 date is found in the statement of Menander, repeated by Josephus as corroborated from Tyrian court records in Against Apion, that Dido's flight, or the founding of Carthage, occurred 143 years and 8 months after Hiram of Tyre sent assistance to Solomon for the building of the temple. So he's talking about 150 years after Solomon and David. So it was after Solomon that the United Kingdom split between Judah and Israel or Samaria, and they ended up going to war against one another. And all the paganism that continued, and then you've got this fight between the priests of Baal and Ahab, and I think Ahab was actually the son of Omri, and Omri was the the really famous Israelite king, and the Assyrians actually called the Israelites by the name of the Israelite king Omri. That's why they called them Gomri, which is where we get the word Cymru from, because the Assyrians used to call them Gomri, and that's written on the Behistun rock. It says Gomri, and then it says Scythians, and then it says Habiru in three different languages. So we know that they were all names for the same people. And from that Gomri, we get Cymmurians, and then we get Cymru as well, for the modern name for the Welsh.
So the Omri was one of the Israelite kings, basically.
Yeah.
Okay, so they inherited the kind of reputation, I'm assuming.
He was a very important king. He was a very well-known king, so the people were named after the king.
Right, that was just around about the same time that they were taken captive.
Well, that was before then, because around about the time that they were taken captive was about 140 years after this, 150 years after this.
So the reputation kind of preceded the time then.
Yeah, Omri's reputation lasted for centuries, really, when you think about it. Using the 825 date, this Tyrian record would then date the start of temple construction in 969 or 968 BC. In agreement with the statement in 1 Kings that temple construction began in Solomon's fourth renal year. Solomon's fourth year can be calculated as starting in the fall of 968 BC when using the widely accepted date of 931 to 930 BC for the division of the kingdom after the death of Solomon. So that was when the United Kingdom spread apart, 930 BC. They really didn't stay together for very long, did they? About 100 years, maybe that?
Yeah. It was. I think it's quite hard to maintain kind of cohesion when you kind of expand so fast and you're just open to change and almost your cultural differences. And, you know, when you stray, it's like a marriage, isn't it? You know, if you grow apart and you change as people, then you have different interests and different motives, and then, you know, conflict comes about. And well, so I guess it's happened throughout Europe, and it's obviously used against us.
Well, they were destined to fall apart and to become separate nations as well. And the reason why they fell apart is because the king that came in after Solomon, he thought, well, now I'm a new king, I'm going to have to crack the whip and rule with an iron fist to get everybody to respect me. And he put loads of taxes on, and he massively taxed the people. And that's why they left. And really, that shows that they didn't have much experience of being kings. Whereas the elder line, the Zara line that actually left Egypt before Moses, they'd been kings of Troy, and they'd started up their kingly lines quite some time before this. In fact, the kingly line starting in Judea was much later, and it was the younger son as well. Zara was the older one. He was the one with the red cord tied around his hand when he put his hand out of the womb first, and then he disappears, and him and his people disappear from biblical history at the time of Moses. So before Moses left Egypt, they left, and that's where you get the kings of Troy. So Troy was going on at the same time as this, with this Dido, because it's mentioned in the Aeneid, all about the Trojans and the Trojan War.
Yeah.
And Aeneas that's mentioned here, obviously, he's the grandfather of Brutus that came to Britain.
Mm-hmm. I think that's, you have to really kind of go through sort of history with a fine comb to understand that perspective of the Bible, because it doesn't really... You can see hints within scripture that can allude to and back up the history. But if you don't know that the history, and which has been buried for the most part, then it's easy to just assume a different set of events and a different kind of timeline and path for the Israelites and especially Judah.
Well, I think a big problem with people today is they assume that it's all just made up stuff. And they're encouraged to believe that. And then when the Jews encourage them to believe that as well. And when people think, well, the Jews must be the people of the Old Testament, and they're saying that it's all just stories that were written down. So why should I believe it?
Fables and...
Yeah.
What would you say? It's almost like allegorical. Allegorical.
Yeah, so they spiritualize it all. A lot of Christians do. They say, oh, well, it's all fairy tales and it was all made up. And yet when you, the more evidence that they found from this time through archaeology, the more it backs up what's actually being said there. And the more it shows that it's accurate. And if it's not accurate, then it's because there's some kind of a mistranslation, which would occur when you're copying these things out and making one copy after another copy, centuries later. You are going to get these mistranslations. But these chronological considerations, therefore, definitely favour the 825 date over the 814 date for Dido's departure to Tyre. And really, 10 years doesn't matter that much, but it's just interesting to see the way that it ties in with Solomon's temple and the construction of that. And it, you know, it just provides more evidence for that and the link between these Phoenicians and the Israelites and Sidon and Tyre. And they were actually building the temple for Solomon. And Solomon would not have had pagans building the temple. He did marry these pagan women, but to actually have pagans building the temple to Yahweh, that would not have gone on. They would have had to have been sanctified people that were building it. More than that, the agreement of this date with the timing of the tribute to Shalmaneser and the year when construction of the first temple began provide evidence for the essential historicity of at least the existence of Pygmalion and Dido, as well as their rift in 825 BC that eventually led to the founding of Carthage. And I do have more on the Israelite link with Carthage and on this Dido and her being the daughter of Jezebel. And I think what we'll do is, because it's quite a long section in a book that I've got, I'll read that out in a later podcast as a narration so people can find out about mm-hmm. that, because the notes that I've got here don't really go into it that much, and it helps to give this extra version of the story. Well, this dating of Dido places the Trojan War at a much later time than usually supposed. If Dido was around at the same time as Innes from the Aeneid, and Innes was the grandfather of Brutus, most scholars believe this war to have taken place around the 11th or the 12th century BC, but renegade historians Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett place it in the 7th century BC, much closer to the time that Josephus places the founding of Carthage. Virgil's story is the same, but he gives different names for the characters. So you have different names, I guess, for these characters, if you have a different ethnicity of the author that's speaking in a different language. And also, I do find it interesting that Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett, I mean, they say that the Trojan War took place in the 7th century BC, and that does tie up a lot of loose ends. But at the same way, having the Trojan War in the 11th or the 12th century BC, that also ties up a lot of loose ends. But it is worth looking at their work. And it does seem here, if you're using this 825 date and Innes is in this, then that implies that the Trojan War took place in the 7th century BC rather than the 11th or the 12th. Mm-hmm. Well, Carthage was one of the largest cities of the Hellenistic period. And note they're calling it the Hellenistic period, so they're already naming this period after the Greeks, even though it was the Phoenicians that were the big power. And it was among the largest cities in pre-industrial history, whereas by AD 14, Rome had at least 750,000 inhabitants, and in the following century may have reached 1 million. The cities of Alexandria and Antioch numbered only a few hundred thousand or less. According to the history of Herodian, Carthage rivaled Alexandria for second place in the Roman Empire after being conquered by Rome. So it was huge before Rome.
Yeah, Rome, the Roman Empire spanned for over 1,000 years. So this was early Rome, wasn't it?
Yeah, this is before Rome became an empire. They went to war against Carthage, and we'll get into that as well, the Punic Wars, after we've discussed it. The Punic Carthage was divided into four equally sized residential areas with the same layout. It had religious areas, marketplaces, a council house, towers, a theatre, and a huge necropolis. Roughly in the middle of the city stood a high citadel called the Byrza. Surrounding Carthage were walls of great strength, set in places to rise above 13 metres, being nearly 10 metres thick, according to ancient authors. I mean, you could, you know, you could ride a chariot around these walls, couldn't you? I mean, I'm always amazed when I look at the castles that we have in Britain today, that the size and the thickness of their walls. In actual fact, there's one in Carnarvon. If you go to the castle in Carnarvon that Edward Longshanks built, that is supposed to have been built to the same pattern as the walls of Constantinople.
Really?
And the castles that were in Constantinople. Yeah, it's got a nice shape to it and feel to it, and the size of it is huge, and it's still there today. It's still in use today. It's managed to survive for 1,000 years.
What do you think the main reason for building such kind of thick walls was back then? Do you think it was defense based, or do you think it was kind of just environmental issues, or just they had more wealth to go around and invest into
defense and prestige. I think it was a bit of both. They needed really thick walls so that they could all get within the city walls and withstand a siege. And I think they also wanted to show off the strength and the wealth that they had with the biggest walls that they could make. To the west, 3 parallel walls were built. The walls altogether ran for about 21 miles to encircle the city. The heights of the Burza were additionally fortified, this area being the last to succumb to the Romans in 146 BC. Originally, the Romans had landed their army on the strip of land extending southwards from the city. So I guess all the important people would have retreated to that last stronghold. And that was the way that it was built. They would have like big walls around the outside, and then more walls on the inside, and then a big tower right in the middle that everybody could get into, the most important people could get into, with enough food to last.
Mm.
They did that in Jerusalem as well. Herod built a tower there for that purpose, I seem to remember. Herod's Tower.
Yeah. Just thinking back to, popped in my head, Hannibal of Carthage.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we're going to be talking about him soon, or
we will probably get to him, but not in this episode. But yeah, he went across the mountains to attack Rome, didn't he?
Yeah, so I'm just trying to place that in relation to this time frame.
A couple of hundred years after this, I would have thought. I mean, we're talking about the founding of Carthage here, really, and now about the city itself. We will get to that. I've seen some images of Hannibal that portray him as a black African.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah.
Fortunately, though, the main image that comes up on Google is definitely a white man, white phenotype. And then you have a lot of different sort of illustrations that try and claim steak, you know, but it's quite ridiculous, isn't it?
They are constantly trying to blackwash history. Between the sea-filled Kothon for shipping and the Burza Heights lay the Agora, or the market, the city-state's central marketplace for business and commerce. The Agora was also an area of public squares and plazas where the people might formally assemble or gather for festivals. It was the site of religious shrines and the location of whatever were the major municipal buildings of Carthage. Here beat the heart of civic life. In this district of Carthage, more probably the ruling suffets or community leaders presided, the council of elders convened, the tribunal of the 104 met, and justice was dispensed at trials in the open air. And that's the word there, suffets. That's the exact same word that you find in the Hebrew Bible for the judges. You remember the book of Judges? And before the Israelites had kings and a monarchy, they were ruled by suffets.
And suffets?
It's a unique word to them.
How do you spell that?
Modern spelling is S-U-F-F-E-T-S. If you want the Hebrew spelling, you'll have to talk for a bit while I look it up.
Okay. Well, suffets, I'm first time I've heard of that word, to be honest. So I'm just curious to, it'll be interesting to see the etymology of it, especially maybe going back to Latin and trying to see the trail back to Paleo Hebrew and Phoenician.
Here we go. I have a quote here from R. Bosworth Smith. 2 supreme magistrates were called by the Romans suffets. Their name is the same as the Hebrew shofetim. The Hamilcars and Hanos of Carthage were, like their prototypes, the Gideons and the Samsons of the Book of Judges, not so much their judges as the protectors and the rulers of their respective states. So the shofetim was the actual word. and the Romans decided that what they would refer to that as is suffix, shofetim, suffetim, or suffet. So they left the im bit off the end of it. So we say s to show a plural, whereas in Hebrew they have im to show a plural. So it's the same thing. Early residential districts wrapped around the Birza from the south to the northeast. Houses usually were whitewashed and blank to the street, but within were courtyards open to the sky. In these neighbourhoods, multi-storey constructions later became common, some up to six storeys tall, according to an ancient Greek author. Several architectural floor plans of homes have been revealed by recent excavations, as well as the general layout of several city blocks. Stone stairs were set in the streets and drainage was planned in the form of soakways leaching off into the sandy soil. Among the Birza's southern slope were located not only fine old homes, but also many of the earliest grave sites juxtaposed in small areas interspersed with daily life. So it sounds very much like villages today, doesn't it? Whitewashed houses, courtyards. I mean, it's how you imagine that, you know. Well, I haven't actually been to the Mediterranean, but I've been to Turkey, and it seems to me like some of the houses there would be sort of open to the sky and sort of Mediterranean, or whatever the word is, where you sit down outside. Courtyard.
Yeah, they have a lot of courtyards, don't they? The design of the house is quite different. My wife's mom lives in from Romania, and they've got a front, large front portion of the house, and then you have like the middle, which is more like a courtyard where they have grow some hanging grapes and things and flowers and just places to congregate. And then there's like a back part of the house, and then there's an extended garden where they grow and kind of cultivate crops and veg and things like that.
Sounds well thought out here as well. They've got the drainage sorted out, so they've got soakways leaching off into the soil away from them. Fine old homes, even architectural plans that have
It makes you wonder, though, the level of sophistication they've got here in cleanliness. And then how did we kind of get to some parts in Europe and, you know, medieval parts where there's kind of the plague going on and the rats in the streets and, you know, kind of almost like Indian sewage systems?
It's hard to believe sometimes, isn't it, really? I mean, maybe they exaggerate it. Maybe they exaggerate it.
Possibly.
You know, you think of them throwing pots of waste out from the windows. And they used to do that in the castles 1,000 years ago. They used to have a bit in the castle where you go to the loo and, you know, it would shoot out the side of the wall. But, that's a long time ago. And yet, I the most amazing thing I thought was when we were talking about the sewage system in that Indus River Valley civilization. And they were the first to dig circular wells. They had fantastic sewage systems that they set up.
Yeah.
2000, 3000 BC. And yet, then we're told today in Britain, you know, it was a pretty stinky place a few hundred years back without people washing. I find that hard to believe.
Yeah.
Artisan workshops were located in the city at sites north and west of the harbours. The location of three metal workshops, which is implied from the iron slag and other vestiges of such activity, were found adjacent to the naval and commercial harbours, and another two were further up the hill towards the Birza citadel. Sites of pottery kilns have been identified between the agora and the harbours and further north. Earthenware often used Greek models. And again, I mean, no, it was the Greeks that used the Phoenician models, not earthenware copying the Greek models. It was the other way around. A fuller shop for preparing woolen cloth, shrunk and thicken, was evidently situated further to the west and the south than by the edge of the city. Carthage also produced objects of rare refinement. During the 4th and the 3rd centuries, the sculptures of the sarcophagi became works of art. Quote here, bronze engraving and stone carving reached their zenith. So they were expert artisans at designing things and pottery there. It sounds like they had everything that a civilization really needed. Very similar to our own. And the next bit, I think, is very similar to our own. South of the citadel, near the Cothon, was the Tophet, a special and very old cemetery, which when begun lay outside the city's boundaries. Here the Salambo was located, the sanctuary of Tanit, not a temple but an enclosure for placing stone stelae. And stelae is what I was thinking of, the Shalmaneser stelae, which is stone basically with engraving on it. These were mostly short and upright, carved for funeral purposes. The presence of infant skeletons from here may indicate the occurrence of child sacrifice, as claimed in the Bible. Although there has been considerable doubt amongst archaeologists as to this interpretation, and many consider it simply a cemetery devoted to infants. Well, how come they have a cemetery devoted to infants? How come there were so many infants that were dying? This is why I say it's similar to today with all the abortions that are going on. These human sacrifices, that they would do that in order to try and get some reward from the gods, some financial reward. The same as women today will have abortions for their career so that they have financial reward. The only difference was that the child had actually been born when they would sacrifice them, these Carthaginians. And they're trying to say today that there is an argument, archaeologists don't know for certain that that was what was going on. But that's what everybody said was going on at the time. That's what all the writers were saying was going on. And of course, they say, that might have been propaganda, you see.
Yeah, I wonder what kind of age does it say what kind of age the children were, infants, sort of,
infants.
Like 3 to 5.
Yeah, months, I should imagine.
Oh, like, okay, fairly like newborn. Babies, basically.
Yeah. Probably the Tophet burial fields were dedicated at an early date, perhaps by the first settlers. Recent studies, on the other hand, indicate that child sacrifice was practiced by the Carthaginians. Tophet is a term originating in the Hebrew Bible. In the Bible, it was a location in Jerusalem in the Gehinnom, where worshippers engaged in a ritual involving passing a child through the fire, most likely child sacrifice. Traditionally, the sacrifices have been ascribed to a god named Moloch. The Bible condemns and forbids these sacrifices, and the Tophet is eventually destroyed by good King Josiah, although mentions by the prophets Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Isaiah suggest that the practices associated with the Tophet may have persisted. And this was one of the pagan practices, this was one of the Canaanite practices that the Israelites picked up and started doing. So again, because you have this mentioned in the Bible and as going on around Israel, the Israelites were not supposed to do it. They were supposed to be against it, but it went on around them. They turned pagan. And then you have exactly the same thing, in Carthage here. And you have the leaders, the judges being called by the same name, the Shofetim. And you have all the actual names that they have, a lot of the names that they have found of these Carthaginians, they're Hebrew names. So they were Israelites. I mean, it's just more proof that the Phoenicians were Israelite. Although it's not very nice proof, the fact that they were doing these human sacrifices.
No, I remember, didn't they used to beat the drums as well, really loud, to kind of mask the screaming of the babies?
I should imagine they would have to do something. They would probably have to do something. I mean, it's just sick when you think about it. You know, they would have these fertility rituals, their orgies, and they would have festivals with music and dancing as well. And then they would have these sacrifices. I don't know whether they would be dancing and singing at the same time as this. I mean, I should imagine it was probably pretty upsetting to sacrifice your child, but they thought that this was going to bring them some good luck. I mean, it may have brought them some good luck. I mean, the devil would give them good luck in order for doing this. That's the way it works.
It is interesting, for sure, like what could be going through someone's mind. I mean, nowadays, if it was to compare it to abortion, like you say, you can see how it's, you know, there's mental gymnastics there to justify it, you know. I mean, some people go as far as saying it's a bunch of cells and stuff, you know, and I think the medical procedure as well is the woman is kind of somewhat removed from it. They don't actually see what's going on. So, you know, psychologically, they're kind of wrapped in cotton wool a bit, aren't they? So I'm trying to think back then, what could have been the frame of mind that they were in to just hand over their own flesh and blood like that.
Oh, they would probably say the same today about what goes on today. I mean, it was just seen as the thing that people did, the same as people see it today as abortion is like an accepted part of the modern world. Human sacrifice was an accepted part of the Canaanite world, isn't it? It was an accepted part of the Israelite world for a time. That's why the Israelites had their land taken away from them. And it was their kings and their leaders that were doing this, the same as today. It's our leaders and our politicians and the heads of and the judges that are making these decisions to make abortion legal, forcing it on Northern Ireland. You know, it was the British politicians, the United Kingdom Parliament that forced it on Northern Ireland.
Yeah, well, I think it's become an industry as well, hasn't it? I think that's what drives a lot of it as well. The fact it just makes money, and you know, there's multiple revenue streams they probably get from babies, the abortion, and the harvesting of organs, which is pretty much a black market, I imagine, stem cells and just what they can extract and resell. Of course, the government's just absolutely corrupt, and these things are likely, you know, why they push it and compromise the. Their moral framework.
Well, I'm sure there would have been a market of or a way to, for them to make money out of this back then as well. They wouldn't have been harvesting body parts, but the priests that did this and the memorials that were made for them, all that sort of thing would have made money. Archaeologists have applied the term Tophet to large cemeteries of children found at Carthaginian sites that have traditionally been believed to house the victims of child sacrifice, as described by Greco-Roman and biblical sources. This interpretation is controversial, with some scholars arguing that the Tophets may have been children's cemeteries, rejecting the Greco-Roman sources as anti-Carthaginian propaganda. But others argue that not all burials in the Tophet were sacrifices. And I think we should probably leave it there. And next week we'll have a look at some of these Greco-Roman sources on the child sacrifices, because they are quite compelling. I don't think it was just propaganda. I mean, you've got them talking about this, and then you've got the evidence of it that we've found today. So it's probably political correctness that is getting people to say, oh, no, that can't have been. It must have just been a cemetery.
Yeah, well, I think also for the reason of connecting it back to other peoples which practice child sacrifice closer to the region, like the Levant, and it's again they're trying to keep it detached to a certain extent. That's what I think, anyway.
Yeah, and of course they wouldn't think to link it with the abortion that goes on today, which is the same thing. It's done in exchange for a perceived reward, financial reward, or a career, or being able to go to college and not being held back. It's the same things when you look at what these parents were hoping to gain from sacrificing their children, the prayers they were offering. It was all for an improvement to their lives in the immediate here and now. It's the same as the unfortunate women today who are having abortions. Well, let's leave it there then. Thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
You're welcome. It's been a good show today.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.